Welcome to the Soft Matter Show. This is Amal Narayanan. I'm a chemist and a polymer scientist. In this podcast, we will talk about soft matter science and have fireside chats with the researchers. Please enjoy the show. Hello, soft matter people. Welcome to another episode of the Soft Matter Show. Our today's guest is Dr. Stephanie Weber. Steph is a professor of biology at the McGill University, Canada. This conversation covers a wide range of topics, starting from mental health to membraneless organelles. Steph shared her thoughts on the contrasts between the research systems of Canada and the United States, and how she overcome mental stress and persisted in academia. Later, Steph provided a summary of what to know about membraneless organelles, also known as condensates. Towards the end, we explored Weber Lab's new research directions in the field of bacterial condensates and much more. On a side note, Steph is an alumni of Cliff Brangwyn's lab at Princeton, where I'm starting as a postdoctoral research associate this week. Super excited. With that, please enjoy this episode. We have Dr. Stephanie Weber here with us today. Steph is a professor of biology at McGill University, Canada. Steph is a recipient of NSF Graduate Research Fellowship and Damon Runyon Fellowship. Steph's work intertwines biology with polymer physics. More specifically, Steph's team at McGill works on phase-separated organelles found in the bacterial cells. With that, let's hear from Steph. Welcome to the Soft Matter Show.
Thanks, Amal. It's great to be here.
So, from your PhD, like you did your PhD in Stanford, which is like in the west coast of United States. Then you did your postdoc at Princeton, which is like northeast, extreme northeast. Then you worked in, you are currently at like Canada, which is like, I would say it's more like northeast. So one of the questions I like to ask the guests that I have in the podcast is that they travel all around the US, at least when they start working. So what are the differences that you have felt in terms of the work and personally while you were a PhD student and a postdoc?
Yeah, I think it's very, very different. Obviously weather-wise, but just culturally outside of lab, and I would even say like workplace environment, I think we're very different in my experience. So California was super laid back. You know, the faculty wore t-shirts and flip-flops into the lab, and it felt like a very sort of flat structure. Like because everyone was so casual, the faculty were, you know, as colleagues. Like even as a first year grad student, I didn't feel like super intimidated by, you know, these big big name faculty. But at Princeton, the faculty during my postdoc, the Princeton faculty wore suits and ties, and it was like very formal. And it created like a little bit of hierarchy and a little bit of like almost separation. Like I am certainly more mature and above you kind of thing, even as a postdoc at that point. And so I think that definitely trickled down to the openness of sharing ideas and talking. And so I think that was a big difference. And I think Canada is a little bit, I haven't been to the west coast of Canada, but I think McGill is kind of halfway in between. It's a little bit more formal than California, but a little bit less rigid than Princeton.
So in terms of the lab culture, like you, when you work in a laid back, environment, people tend to be more philosophical than when you are in a very restricted and a fast paced environment, right? So which of the philosophy that have you adopted in terms of your setting up your current lab?
Yeah. So I definitely have a list of things that I've taken from both. So Julie Terry was my supervisor at Stanford, and Cliff Brangwyn, who you are going to work with, was my postdoc supervisor. And so, I definitely took things from both of them, but I think, I don't know if it was just, I spent more time there and was sort of like forged there, but I definitely was more comfortable and had more fun in the Stanford sort of, more open, flatter environment. And so I've probably erred on too far of being, you know, friends with my students as opposed to their not superior, but I'm not very good at
being the bossy boss,
imposing boundaries. and I've never been very good at work-life balance. So I think I've just kind of made the lab my family and my home, and that works really well for me. And I think for some, you know, for some students that's great. I think other students prefer more of a separation and sort of formal relationship with their supervisor, and that's fine too. And I think actually that's one really important thing that I've learned going through academia, is that there is no one single way to run a lab or one right or wrong way. Different people thrive in different environments, and you have to find the place that is best suited for you. And that place may actually change over time as you learn and grow, and as different people, you know, come and go in a lab. One thing that I thought Julie did really well as a supervisor was she treated each student differently, and it wasn't in a play favorites kind of way. It was different students needed different things. Like, I was very self-motivated and didn't need a lot of direction or a kick in the butt, but some people were kind of like, you know, lost and flailing and needed structure, and she was able to provide that, but she didn't rein people in if they didn't need that structure. And I think that was a real strength of hers, and something that I've been trying to learn, but it's really hard to know what a student needs, and they might not even be self-aware at the time to know themselves.
Yeah,
and it's sort of a learning process on both the student and the supervisor's part. That's something that I'm constantly sort of adjusting and struggling to learn, but.
Yeah, this is a point actually like came again and again. This has come when I did my podcast with the Dr. Abraham Chai, who was my advisor. So he was also stressing on the point that, you know, there's no one single blanket for everyone. And I never thought about that in a, you know, that way ever about mentoring. I thought it's about me who is, you know, mentoring people. So I design my personality in a way that it suits them. Instead, it's like the other way around. So yeah, that's a very excellent point. I agree. So how about like in US, like in the US, like you have NSF, you have NIH, there are like DOD and DOE and other funding mechanisms. How does it work in Canada?
Yeah. I think that is one of the biggest differences between the US academic system and Canada is the funding system. So we have similar federal agencies, right? So the NSF, we have NSERC, which is it's a basic science equivalent. You guys have NIH, we have CIHR, which is the Canadian sort of biomedical health equivalent. And so from that perspective, it's similar. But the size of those grants are very different. So when I started my lab, I didn't get $1 million startup package. I got 100K. And so I immediately had to start applying for grants, like right away. And you're expected to get a grant, you know, in your first year or two, which is very different from the US. And so I think there's just a little bit of a difference in pace and scope that you can start out on with your lab. And the other big difference is the Canadian system is a little bit more socialist. So NSERC, the success rate to get an NSERC grant, which is these basic science grants, is about 60-65%. So almost everyone has an NSERC, but it's only 30K. Mm-hmm. So it's really small. It'll fund one or two students. But everyone, it's kind of like a universal basic income a little bit, right? Like almost every lab has one. But to try to apply for a bigger it's the NIH equivalent, the CIHR, that has a success rate of like 14%. So that is just as difficult and competitive, and they're still not as big as a NIH R1. And so because of that, I think, you know, labs in Canada are smaller on average, and there's a lot of co-supervised students, and there's a lot more like collaborations because no one lab can afford to do anything on their own. And so I think because of that, the culture is a little bit more friendly and less competitive, just because you can't scoop out your neighbor. You have to join forces with your neighbor, which quite frankly, I find a very fun and nurturing place, especially to start a lab. I think mid-career is you get squeezed. It's hard to grow, mm-hmm. you know, like you can establish yourself, but it's hard to pick up momentum and build and grow. But it is very different.
So how are the students paid? Is it the same way in the US, like you bring the funding and you get paid? The reason why I ask this is because I studied in India, so there a lot of the funding comes from the government directly to the students. So their fellowship is already taken care. So all you need to provide is mostly the, you know, funding for the lab equipments and the chemicals and things like that. So is that how does it compare to how we provide funding to students across US and Canada?
Yeah, so I think we individual faculty have to pay, you know, stipend and tuition for students. The tuition is much lower in Canada than it is in the States. So so one graduate student would probably stipend and funding would probably be about 20K ish. And there are fellowships available, but you know, they're as difficult and competitive to get as they are in the States. But the tuition is certainly lower than it is at some private schools in the US. I think because of the smaller grant sizes, not only are labs smaller, but the way that students are recruited is very different. So there are no training grants. And so there's no rotation system because there's no way to fund first year graduate students as they sort of sample different labs, which, as I mentioned, is a great way to find the right environment. And so, having no rotations is, I think, a real challenge, both from a student finding their right fit of an environment, but also from a faculty's perspective of recruiting students. So students apply directly to me, not to McGill Biology.
Okay.
And so it's this direct admit process. And you commit to someone for an entire PhD based on a Skype call or you don't get that like dating period of a rotation to really see how they perform, how they interact with other members of their group. And that, to me, is a very uncomfortable process and must be really scary on the student's perspective too, to commit to someone that you don't know that well. So I think student recruitment is another huge difference. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that is different and was very strange to me and still is kind of odd is in the US, typically you enter graduate school for a PhD and there's no terminal master's. So, you can leave with a master's if you things don't go well, or if you decide you want to leave and they'll give you a master's. But typically people don't go to graduate school for the purpose of getting a master's. And it's somewhat perceived as a failure, right or wrong, that is somewhat the perception. In Canada, that's not at all the case. It's almost expected that you do a master's before you do a PhD. Mm-hmm. And so the master's program is actually like quite vibrant. But that is challenging because the time scale and the risk and the scope of a project that you can do in a 2 years master's is very different than what you can do in a 5 year PhD. And so coming up with projects that are, you know, less risky and more sure to work out is just a different type of challenge.
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic idea to do a master's because, you know, in a way you are forced to do some research in a certain time period. So you don't get the freedom in the beginning. So you get the best training with that time. So it's not about the productivity, more of the training. This is like a forced training. So you end up, you know, exposing yourself into the research and you learn things faster. In a PhD, like when it's a longer marathon-like process, when you're laid back a little bit compared to a master's, which is my belief. Because when I did my master's back in India, so then we had an option to, I mean, you have to graduate in like certain time of certain time point, so which is faster. Yeah. So you had to get exposed to some amount of research and other things during the process. So one of the things, like, you know, this is probably is personal. So, but what are the factors that contributed you to, you know, move to Canada to pursue your academic career, even though you've spent most of your life in the US?
Yeah. So I'm American. I grew up in the States. I did all my training in the States. Yeah, no, it was a very easy decision. I only got one job offer and it happened to be in Canada. So I moved.
That sounds fantastic way of selecting it.
McGill was actually the only place outside of the US that I even applied. I had no intention of leaving the US. It is a great fit and they offered me a job, so I took it.
So did you knew about all this system before you applied, or, you know, or did you learn that with the process?
No, not at all. I had no idea what I was getting into. So McGill is also in Montreal, which is in Quebec, which is a primarily French-speaking province. And so the city itself is very different than the States. And I mean, I, as an American, think it feels very European. My European friends think that it feels very American, but it is definitely a multicultural, very diverse place. So from a cultural perspective, moving to Canada, moving to Montreal in particular, was very different from where I grew up, and moving to, you know, the Canadian funding system and the different academic structure was also somewhat of a culture shock.
So yeah. Do you speak French or? Okay. I don't know.
A little bit. Okay. I mean, I've taken French classes and I can read pretty well, but I can't really carry on a conversation.
Yeah. The one of the things, like, I mean, while I was doing my undergrad, so I got an opportunity to go to China for a conference. That's when I decided that I'm not going to do my PhD anywhere other than an English-speaking country. So this should be very threatening. I mean, you know, it's very hard for me to, you know, go to a place and you don't know anything about. But yeah, it's easier to pick up, or maybe you can speak a little bit and then get ahead with it, I guess.
Yeah, I have to say, like, it has given me, it has been such a humbling experience to live in Quebec. And I have such a greater appreciation for students who English is their second language, and just the amazing challenge that they have had to overcome and succeed in performing in a different language. I mean, I can barely order a coffee and they can, you know, give scientific talks. It's amazing. And it really has, I think, given me a small sliver of a perspective of, you know, what it feels like to come in from outside.
Yeah, I think in science it is quite useful to know French as well. I think because in the older generations there are papers still wrote in French, and I mean along with other European languages. But yes, French was also one of the, you know, initial science languages. So
yeah.
Like, I noticed one thing in your you know, your, as I was doing the research for your interview, that you had a stint in Santa Clara University as a, you know, lecturer. How did that happen? And I'm very curious to know, how did that help you and how did that happen?
Yeah. So there's a long story and there's a short story to it. But the short story
I have all the time you got.
Yeah. All right. Well, the short story is I didn't get any job offers. And the academic job offers. Tenure track research academic job offers, and teaching had always been my plan B. And so that was the job I took.
Okay.
The longer it ends, about 2 weeks after I accepted that lecture position, McGill called and said, "So are you still interested in the tenure track position?" I was their number two and the first. They made an offer to another candidate and they had, you know, eventually declined. And so I was able to defer McGill a year, and I'm very glad that I ended up here. But the longer story is that I was really unhappy in my postdoc. It was a rough time in my life, and I was depressed and suicidal and really struggling with my mental health in my postdoc. And I knew that it was not safe for me as a human being to stay and try the job market another year. And so it took me months of existential crisis and I don't mean to overly dramatize that, but it really was a difficult decision to recognize that I needed to do something else and I needed to do something for me. And I got a lot of advice from very well-meaning friends and mentors telling me that it would be a really bad career move to teach. And it had gotten to the point where it was the only healthy decision that I could make. And so I did it. And that year of teaching, so first of all, it was full-time teaching. So I taught four brand new courses in 1 year, three quarters. It was just so intense. Mm-hmm. But it was just a totally different atmosphere, different type of mental challenge. And it was a sabbatical. It was a mental break that I needed away from the grind of science. And I through sort of interacting with enthusiastic students, I this sounds so corny, but I rediscovered why I love science. And I just got off of the publish or perish kind of stress, and was able to remember and appreciate the small sort of eureka, like, you know, light bulb goes off moments in seeing it through students' eyes. And so that saved my life, but saved my career, because I was able, when I did come to McGill a year later, I was able to engage in science again, like with enthusiasm and not with, oh my God, this is what I have to do because I am on this treadmill and I need to just keep pushing. And that's what my postdoc had become. And it was my plan B. Teaching was always my plan B. And I'm so glad that I did it. And I don't think it necessarily, you know, will always work out to take a B job and end up back at your A job. But for me, it was absolutely the best thing that could have happened to me.
So looking back, what do you think has helped you to overcome all the stressful periods of your life?
Yeah.
I mean, this is just for, you know, I'm asking is because like there are so many people that I know, I mean, with prolific research track records, and still they undergo a lot of stress during their, I mean, as a third person, I can tell, oh, you're going to do good. But that is not what the person is. So if there are any resources that you would like to share, or like any helpful pathways that you would like to share, that if somebody is going through something of that sort, they could, you know, figure out themselves.
Yeah. I'll be honest, there is no magic bullet, and I still, you know, it's sort of a daily struggle. But I think for me, recognizing it and admitting it is really powerful, because for a while I was trying so hard to hide it because I thought it made me look weak and not, you know, able to survive or, you know, be successful. Building a support network of colleagues and of friends, you know, outside academia that know and that support you and love you anyway. So it was actually a lab mate who sort of pulled an intervention with me almost during my postdoc and said, like, Steph, I'm worried about you. Like, are you okay? And I burst into tears, and she helped me get to a therapist, and I started meds. And I mean, but having people help you find resources and recognizing that it's not a sign of weakness, it's actually like a sign of strength. If you were having trouble in the lab and something wasn't working, you wouldn't just beat your head against the wall and keep pushing through. You would go ask someone else for help, or you would read the literature, or you would seek out resources from other experts. And I think the same is true for mental health. Mm-hmm. So for me, therapy, medication, and exercise. I picked up running during my postdoc, and that has been just a mentally freeing activity as much as a physical activity. During the pandemic, I've picked up yoga because wow. I was stuck in my apartment. But I think just taking time, and this is easier for me to say than to do. I do not follow this advice.
So you mean myself, like, but a habit, or you know, like a continuous chain of habits, or keeping yourself busy during the teaching and like being with the friends, or that also helps. Is that what you're saying? Is that what you're saying? In addition to what you had, your therapy and the medications, do you think that a continuous flow of something else, like a sabbatical sort of, did you think that helped a lot to you, right?
Yes, absolutely. And carving out time, like regular time, away from the lab or away from the computer, to do something that you enjoy, mm-hmm. that is separate.
Yeah, this is so surprising. I mean, I did not know about this. So, it's very inspiring for me to also, like, you know, you went through that path and, you know, came back with a bang, I would say. So congratulations to you, actually.
Thanks.
So you were talking about the when you did that, when you're doing the teaching, you learned from the students and you got the joy of science again. So how did you get inspired in the first place to start doing science?
I don't think I had like one, you know, eureka moment. I always liked figuring things out. I really liked animals. I wanted to be a marine biologist when I was a kid and swim with the dolphins. So I went to Duke for college specifically because they had a marine lab. And I spent a summer in Beaufort on the coast of North Carolina, going out on boats to observe dolphins. And oh my God, it is so boring. Mm-hmm. It is awful. Mm-hmm. I hate observational science. I like, you know, just not being able to control what is going to happen and sitting there for hours in the hot sun and having a clipboard and no notes. I always liked animals and sort of nature, but in college I realized that sort of organismal scale biology was not for me. I didn't have the patience for it. And I loved organic chemistry. I loved pushing electrons around. And so I sort of stumbled into more molecular scale stuff. And then it wasn't until graduate school when I like first looked through a microscope, like a fluorescence microscope, and saw things moving around inside the cell. And I was hooked. Like, that was amazing.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds very interesting. That's like, actually is a perfect time to talk about the membraneless organelles, I would say. So, I mean, there are listeners in this podcast which are from totally a soft matter, or like, you know, polymer physics or polymer science, or even like, you know, regular undergraduate students. So can you describe what the field of membraneless organelles mean, and how did it change the field of cell biology?
Yeah, so it really has been, you know, about 10 years, and there's just been like this huge revolution in how we think about cells. So traditionally, so cells are the smallest unit of life. Your body is made up of, you know, trillions of cells, and each cell has like different compartments, just like, you know, your house has different rooms, different places in the cell are specialized for different functions. And most of these compartments are surrounded by a membrane. And a membrane creates a diffusion barrier that prevents molecules from diffusing from inside and outside. And that allows the cell to have a different composition, different types of molecules inside each compartment than outside and from other compartments. And that allows a specialization so that certain types of reactions can occur in different places and different times in the cell. And so the cell can sort of organize all of its biochemical processes that way. And until about 10, 12 years ago, that was sort of the paradigm. But Cliff Brangwyn and Tony Hyman made some beautiful observations of these what are called now called membraneless organelles or condensates moving around inside the cell. And basically what they saw were droplets of bright molecules sort of condensing and forming and fusing and dripping and wetting and behaving like droplets or like raindrops on a car windshield. And these movies these organelles moving around inside the cell were just spectacularly beautiful and very different from anything else I had ever seen in a cell. And so the way that Cliff and the field started thinking about these structures was like drops of oil in water. So if you think about salad dressing, you shake it up, you can have these separate layers of oil and water, even though there's no like physical barrier between them. And so you can compartmentalize the cell or your salad dressing through this physical process of these molecules self-associating and or separating from each other. And so the way that we describe this now is called liquid-liquid phase separation. And so you have molecules inside the cell, proteins, nucleic acids, and they're sticky. So they stick to each other, but each of these sticky interactions is really weak. So individually, they will come together transiently and then fall apart and diffuse away. But collectively, they're really strong. And so if you have enough of these molecules above some threshold concentration, then these molecules come together and form these condensates, these organelles that are of different physical properties and different chemical composition from the surrounding medium of the cell. And so it provides cells a different mechanism to spatially compartmentalize their stuff. And what's amazing is that they're really dynamic. So they can assemble and disassemble within seconds to minutes, whereas membrane-bound organelles take much more time and energy to build and destroy. And so it allows, or it appears, I would say this is still an open question, but it appears to allow the cell to respond very quickly to environmental cues or developmental cues, to regulate and control different biochemical processes in the cell.
That summarizes a lot of information. So one of the things when I was trying to look at from a polymer science background, so which was surprising for me though this phase separation or liquid-liquid phase separation is a well-defined process in colloids and in polymers, it was very exciting to see that it also happens inside cells and to see those liquid-like or even like solid-like phase-separated compartments to sustain, which is necessary for sustaining the life of ourselves and many other organelles or organisms. So what are some of the striking results that, the point I'm trying to ask is that you watched it live, like you said 10 years ago. So 10 years ago is somewhere around when you started your postdoc, I would say, right? So then I think phase separation was not a big field in biophysics. So what was it like to watch the growth of the phase separation field inside cells look like?
Yeah. It was a pretty, I had definitely had a sort of front row seat to watch the field sort of blow up. And it was both really exciting and shocking, quite frankly. I would guess I was just naive at the time, but also a little bit frustrating. So initially, no one knew what it was. And I should also say that, I picked up some polymer physics in grad school, but I'm not trained as a material science or polymer physicist. And so I was not very familiar with the long history of polymer physics and phase separation in colloidal systems and stuff. And I think that's actually a a challenge in the field is communicating across this, you know, cell biology and physics disciplinary, I don't want to say divide because it is a very interdisciplinary field, but it is certainly true that many people come with lacking one background or another. I think it was a beautiful, intriguing phenomenon that people didn't really understand how to describe or what its significance was initially. But then once it was first described in C. elegans, which is this, you know, nematode, which is a model system, and it's this beautiful system, but it's, you know, it's maybe a random one-off kind of oddity. But then it became, you know, increasingly clear that, okay, no, it's everywhere. This process is happening in all cells. It also seems to be important in a lot of disease states. So, you know, but as it gained more and more momentum, a lot of people, you know, started jumping on the bandwagon, and every little bright spot inside a microscope image, oh, that must be a droplet, that must be a condensate. And, you know, I forgot to mention, but these, a lot of these sticky molecules that undergo this process of phase separation, are what are referred to as intrinsically disordered. So they have like really floppy, conformationally flexible structures. And so there were a few years in like 2012, 2015, where the cover of Cell, every single issue, had a new disordered protein that when you purified it, it formed droplets. And oh, that must be exactly what it's doing inside the cell and solving all of the world's problems. And it was somewhat frustrating because it was just used as a explanation for everything without much rigorous evidence. And the reason is because it's really hard to study in cells, partly because we don't have the tools and partly because the field is still trying to understand how to apply these very well-established thermodynamic theories from you know, physical chemistry into cells which are finite and non-equilibrium and heterogeneous and multi-component. And so all of these, you know, assumptions that are made in many of the founding theory do not hold inside the cell. And so it's not, you know, for a while it was, you know, is this an analogy or is this really what's happening? And there was a challenge of really rigorously describing and quantitatively predicting what is going on inside the cell, and is what we're observing with a purified protein in vitro, is that actually what is occurring in cells?
That tells a lot about any research field, actually, not just about this particular theory, because there are so many research areas in which, you know, one fancy looking or like one more, you know, easy to explain or happy, like, you know, that such findings happen, then people do follow up because it's easier to show, but not necessarily to translate to what you really are talking about, that the analogies that you're making would not be staying in a certain conditions that you're providing. So as we go to that, when we talk about the liquid-liquid phase separation as one of the theories for the stability of the droplets inside the cells. So what are some of the controversies, if there are any, like, which exist, or like, is there any other counter theory in this field which exists, why these droplets are stable inside the cells?
Yeah, I mean, of course there's controversies. It's a new field, and we don't really know what's going on, right? So there are multiple competing hypotheses. I think, you know, whether or not any local concentration of protein that you see in a cell, whether it forms through this condensation process or whether it is binding to some scaffold, and, you know, whether it's dynamic because the molecules can internally rearrange like it's a liquid, or whether it's binding and unbinding from a stationary scaffold, that is a particularly I think, I don't know, controversial question in the nucleus, because you can have proteins that are sticky, but they also associate with DNA. So are they binding the DNA, or are they condensing and then associating with the DNA? And what is the role of DNA in stabilizing these condensates? And I think, I mean, I guess I am of the opinion that whether it is true, pure liquid-liquid phase separation or some other process, like, is not that it doesn't matter, because we want to be able to describe it, like, accurately and understand the process. But there are probably multiple different things going on in the cell in different contexts, and I don't think it all has to be one way or the other. And I think the some people in the science media or some journals set it up as a controversy or a debate. And really, we're all just trying to understand what we're observing and describing it in the best way that we can. And there are a lot of different ideas out there. I think there is some competing models out there, but I'm not of the opinion that one will be the end all be all and absolutely correct, and the other one will be absolutely wrong. I think you'll see various different things happening in different contexts in the cell, and one might be more appropriate and I think we just need more data and more theory again to really describe what is going on.
Yeah, I agree. Things are lost in translation as well. If things get simple, that means there's something wrong. So it's highly likely that multiple things are happening at the same time, and or maybe at this particular certain condition, one applies more than the other, which could be what is happening in any theories. So this is like a perfect time for me to ask about your current research. So what are the recent findings that you have been going on within the lab and which is excites you the most?
Yeah, so when I was in Cliff's lab, I worked in C. elegans. So this is nematode worm. And I was, really excited about it because this beautiful live cell imaging. I was studying the embryo at the time, but now we're looking in developing worms. And so the embryo is sort of like this confined test tube, and the growing worm is this open, dynamic system. So that is one particularly exciting place. So we're looking at the structure and function of the nucleolus, another membranous organelle, and how it changes in, growing larvae, in aging adults, in dormant starved worms, and, the structure and presumably activity, ribosome biogenesis activity, does change in each of those different sort of biological contexts. And we're trying to understand how that is regulated and how... So the material properties of the nucleolus is either regulating ribosome biogenesis, or changes in ribosome biogenesis are changing the material properties of the nucleolus. So that's one project. And then the other project that I'm super excited about is we've started looking at this process in bacteria. So until like just 2 or 3 years ago, all of the examples of liquid-liquid phase separation in cells had been in eukaryotic cells. And that's primarily because they're big and you can image them. but bacteria are really small and don't have any, organization, because they're just so small and simple and diffusion is sufficient. And that's clearly not the case. But it's also really hard to study these because everything is diffraction limited and everything is so small. And so when I started the lab, I kind of naively thought, oh, well, I did phase separation in C. elegans, and I studied, bacterial processes in grad school. I'll combine them and that will make me, unique and independent scientist. And right, that was my career strategy. And so I went back and looked at the microscope. I'm like, oh my God, the entire bacteria fits inside the nucleolus of the C. elegans, right? Just the scale, the length scales are just orders of magnitude different. And so because of that, we couldn't use fluorescence recovery after photo bleaching, or many of the typical experimental tools that people have been using in, you know, for a decade in eukaryotic cells. So we have sort of found examples of phase separation. Me and other labs have found examples of phase separation in bacteria, but it's much harder to identify and to really definitively characterize at that length scale.
Yeah, because it's a lot of spatial constraints too, right? It's very small, and how big a drop can get, right? So there's a limit.
And even just, even just the question of like how small is a drop, is still a drop, right? Like,
yeah.
So there's almost like philosophical questions of finite size effects.
There's something we often discuss in our lab as well. Like, you know, when you talk about like, oh, you found a liquid phase separation. So, but like, where are the droplets that you're not seeing inside the microscope, or even when you do a light scattering? I mean, this happens even in vitro, not just in vivo. Like, you know, you never know what is the smallest length scale it can be, right? Yeah, that sounds very exciting. So what are the implications of phase separation in microbials that you have thought through?
Yeah, so I mean, at this point, we've been looking at RNA polymerase, and so we're thinking about transcriptional regulation. Very, very similar questions that have been explored in the eukaryotic nucleus. But the thing that I'm most excited about, and to be perfectly honest, is pure speculation still at this point. But because most bacteria lack membrane-bound organelles, phase separation could be a more important process for regulating. I don't want to say everything, but you know, for regulating biochemical reactions in bacteria, because they don't have this other dominant, you know, form of spatial organization, this could be a potentially easier to measure functional consequences. Because I think one thing that's been really challenging in the phase separation field is, you know, we can describe the assembly and disassembly and observe them and characterize all of their molecular components, but really like measuring function and separating phase separation from the molecular function of the proteins that do that undergo the phase separation is really challenging, right? You can mutate and perturb the phase separation process, but does that also change the activity of that enzyme that you know does its function in the organelle? And so I think in eukaryotes it's been really hard because many of the processes that are potentially, you know, regulated by condensates is subtle. You know, it's a couple percent up and down. But in bacteria, maybe that's the only regulation present. And so maybe that could be a easier place to measure function. So that is my goal. That is my hope. That is what I've told all of the funding agencies. Quite frankly, we aren't there yet.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of wishful thinking. But yeah, I mean, if that is the case, you're gold. So so right now, like one of the reasons I started this podcast was like, you know, to get the students of different parts of the world to get to a PhD, or, you know, or if they are interested in pursuing a research career, so they will get introduced to how a scientist would talk or how a scientist would, like, you know, be in looks like in person. So one thing I want to ask you is that do you have any message for students, future students, like for PhD or postdoctoral students who would like to work with you in McGill?
Oh,
yeah, I'm trying to switch the gear a little bit, like from research to a, you know, more of a mentoring aspects of it.
Yeah, but I mean, do you mean in terms of like applying to lab
In terms of applications, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I mean, at McGill, I mentioned recruitment is different. It's not unlike in the U.S. When I applied to graduate schools, I, you know, didn't contact individual professors. But in Canada, you kind of have to contact individual professors, and that could be a super intimidating prospect, right? Sending an email to specific faculty members. I think the biggest piece of advice I would have is when you think about what you want to study for in the future, what is the most exciting types of questions that are out there, and why are you interested in that lab or that field in particular? I get a lot of emails from students that say, I have done this and I know this technique and this technique and this technique and I can do this. Mm. But they don't say what they are interested in doing in the future or why they want to study phase separation in cells or whatever. And I'm much more interested in their curiosity and sort of questions than I am in what they can do. Because as you said, you will learn new things in graduate school and you will be trained. And so it is great to have experience and to have, dabbled in some things, as an undergraduate or as a master's student. But the truth is you probably haven't been exposed to a broad, like what all is out there in science. And I was certainly like this as an undergraduate. I wanted to study RNA biochemistry because that was the coolest thing that was happening at Duke when I was an undergraduate. I had never knew about cell biology and what was happening inside cells because that just wasn't what I was exposed to at the time. And so I think being open to new ideas and sort of learning new things, I think is really what we're all in this for. And being able to articulate what you're curious about and what interests you going forward, to me is much more exciting to sort of think about how this student could fit into my lab than these are the skills that I bring.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds like a very summarized way of advice for students who are coming and trying to apply for PhDs anywhere around the world. So these are like last closing questions. So what are your, do you have any advices for the next generation of scientists? This could be very random. I mean, this is just like a side note of to people who are trying to get into academy or even trying to pursue research in an industrial background as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really easy to get lost in the rat race of publish and perish and what is my H index and what and the truth is those things matter, unfortunately, because they get you fellowships and they get you jobs and they get you, but they can become consuming and overwhelming and make you lose sight of why science is fun and interesting to begin with. And they cause you to focus on the competition and the, more so than the questions and the people. And so I think what I learned, especially, during my tough postdoc, was that, I come to the lab every day now because, well, pre-pandemic, because I like the curiosity and excitement of asking questions and bouncing ideas off of curious and creative people around me. And having friends and colleagues that are interested in ideas and open-minded and supportive, I think is more important than, like, I've never published in Science, Nature, Cell, and I have really good friends and colleagues from graduate school, from my postdoc, from McGill, and that is way more important and has allowed me to continue in science and stay in science. And so if you think about and you focus on the questions and the people around you, I think you can be successful in life and having a fulfilling career, maybe not Nobel Prize, you know, cover of nature kind of.
Well, you never know.
yeah. Maybe it'll lead there, yeah. Focusing on the questions and the people, I think it would be my advice.
Yeah, I agree. So that's a very good summary of what a next generation scientist would look for from hearing from you. So I had to ask this, like, you're so energetic. Like you have this. I attended your talk in IT. I think in the ITS Institute. You had a talk almost a year ago. Then even now you have superb energy. How do you maintain that energy? And like, is there any secret recipe that I could use?
No, there is no secret. This is me. This is me uncaffeinated.
Uncaffeinated.
Uncaffeinated. I have just always been like inherently energetic, and I mean, my parents would say bouncing off the walls and, you know, trying to like quiet me down. I often, you know, get shushed because I'm too loud. There's no secret sauce. This is just how I'm wired for better or worse.
That is awesome, actually, because especially in an online lecture, it's very hard to keep the, you know, 100% attention inside, because you're using the same device which you use for a lot of random scrolling and stuff. So it's very hard to focus. But your talk was like, I mean, that was probably one of my first early Zoom talks, and I was like 100% into it. It's like, I think it's because of your energy, and definitely because of your research, but I think it's more so because of your, you know, energy, which is fantastic. I think I wish all the best for you to, you know, keep up that energy, and which is very positive for and reinforcing for and the listeners. Yeah, so that's all I got. So thank you for taking the time, and like, you know, I'm so glad that you made the time to talk to us in the Soft Matter show. Yeah, do you have any closing remarks, or is there anything? I mean, do you think you're good? Okay, cool.
So, no, I think that's fine. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. So thank you. Thank you so much for your time.
That's it for today, guys. I hope you all enjoyed this episode. Please find the show notes at thesoftmattershow.com for more details. That is thesoftmattershow.com. You can write your questions, suggestions, and everything else to me at amalnarayanan@thesoftmattershow.com. See you with another exciting episode soon. Until then, goodbye.